So this is a lecture on James Baldwin. It's going to be short, if for no other reason than that I'm in my office and it's like 94 degrees and I don't have any air conditioning. So this is not going to go on for very long. But there's another reason, which is that we've already encountered a whole lot of the issues that James Baldwin is bringing up here because we went ahead and read Ta-Nehisi Coates from 2015. And when I read that Coates book for the first time, I recognized right away, because I've been reading James Baldwin for a while, that this is a reference. The whole book is a reference to James Baldwin, and the themes that are developed in the books are developments of thoughts, maybe not first, but definitely clearly present within James Baldwin, within his writing in the 1960s. So I give you one and then the other because I want you to think about the kind of rhetorical framing. You know, so both of them, Coates is writing to his son. He's copying Baldwin, or, you know, he's riffing on Baldwin. Baldwin's writing to his nephew, right? Here are individuals writing about the contexts that they inhabit and trying to develop some kind of critical and responsible attitude towards those contexts. And one reason that they are doing this, at least rhetorically, is that they feel an obligation to the next generation and to their own family, to the young people in their family, to tell the truth about the world and to come up with some kind of guide to try to determine, you know, what is wisdom in our real contexts. And that's something I'm encouraging you to really think about in this class. Like, how do we get away from classes that have no connection to our lives and questions that have no connections to our lives to questions that have everything to do with our lives? How do we take an educational experience and make it actually educational according to our guidelines, right? Okay, so who's James Baldwin? James Baldwin was a key figure involved with, you might say, the civil rights movement, you might say the black power movement, historically both. He's a black guy who grew up in Harlem. Eventually, he spent a lot of his life in Paris, and I think that may have had something to do with the fact that he was gay and therefore didn't feel as welcome within black communities as he might have otherwise. Maybe it also had to do with the general conditions of life within this country, which, you know, though France also is a racist nation and a colonial nation, Baldwin felt, and a lot of people felt, at least in the first half of the 20th century, I don't know if this is true now, that life in Paris was quite different from life in the United States, and that especially being black in Paris was different than being black in Harlem, in the U.S. I think it's quite important to realize, you know, so here you are in college, and so many of us just think that we're here to get a degree so that we can get a good job, and nothing really matters unless it's going to teach you that skill to make that money. But if you're completely unaware of the rest of the world beyond these borders, well, then the possibilities that are available to you and that you are going to select among are also really, really small and thin and few. And therefore, what your life could be is radically limited. So, you know, Baldwin will tell you, you got to recognize that America is not the world, but the world is available to you. Right. This comes back to my basic idea that I would like to convince you to use your education and your time at a university for real purposes that are self-determined purposes, which do involve, you know, realizing what the world is like. Anyway, so Baldwin came back to the U.S. Because as the civil rights and then the black power movement got going, because he felt that he had an obligation. He felt that he was responsible and needed to be involved with this movement somehow or other. He's a literary figure. He's a writer who published, I don't know how many books, I'd say at least a dozen books. Very well respected, very well known writer of the 1950s to, say, 1970s. Okay, that's who he is. The text, as I said, is very similar to the Coates text. I think it's the text that Coates was primarily looking at and thinking about when he wrote what he wrote more recently in 2015. one more thing, which is connected to, and actually I gave you two texts, right? I gave you the famous essay from 1965, My Dungeon Shook, or it might even, it's from the book, The Fire Next Time, which I think is 1965. The essay may have even been written a little bit earlier, around 1963, 64. And that's the talk to teachers that I also gave you, because I want to keep emphasizing this question about what is education? Where are we? What are we doing? That's also 1963. Okay, so what's the general logic about why I'm giving you this stuff? And by the way, if you're getting all annoyed, and I don't think most of you are, but I know a couple of you are, if you're getting annoyed that everything seems to have to do with race and attacking America, which is really not what I think is happening here, but from a conservative perspective, it's easy to see why you might think that. It's not going to be like this, everything we read. You'll be happy, if you're that person, you'll be happy to know that after this, we're going on to Socrates and Plato and Descartes and some standard philosophical stuff for a little while. But the basic idea here, the reason to keep driving about these questions about where are we, what is our context, what is the world that surrounds us? What are the structures which bear upon us and determine us, whether we know it or not? The point of that is in order to be able to be honest and coherent and sane and sober people who are talking about the real world and not a bunch of dreams. This is something both Coates and Baldwin point at, the idea that a whole lot of Americans live in basic delusion. Here, Baldwin's going to call it infantilism. You know, we're going to, or he thinks that a whole bunch of people who believe in a bunch of myths and never look any further beyond those myths are effectively stuck in childhood. They never grow up. But he thinks we would do well to do so. So this is the reason for these critiques. I'm not trying to convey a negative attitude towards the country or towards education, except insofar as, you know, negative attitude and a critical attitude might be similar. What they have in common is that a critical attitude and a negative attitude both say, hold on, hold on, hold on, about whatever we're given from outside. The negative attitude is not very interesting. If it just says, okay, whatever is around us is bad, well, so what? But the critical attitude is more interesting. Hold on, hold on, hold on about what I'm always being told about the American dream, about, like, you know, the superiority of capitalism, about America's being the greatest country in the world. Hold on, hold on, hold on. If that then leads me to try to ask questions about what's really going on and about where I really am, that's the beginning of science. That's the beginning of philosophy. Only when we recognize our ignorance, Socrates will tell us, are we in a position then to begin to seek the truth. So long as we believe the falsehoods that surround us, so long as we think that we know everything, our arrogance, hubris is the Greek word, will prevent us from ever learning anything. You're never going to know anything if you think you know when you don't. And those of us who repeat these things about this is the freest country in the world, we don't know what we're talking about. Now, that sounds just anti-American, but it's not. It's pro-philosophical. It's pro-scientific. When we say that, have we even defined freedom? Do we really know what we're talking about, or are we just saying things? Just saying things gets in the way of knowing anything. And if we hold on to things that are just given us that we're supposed to repeat, out of what? Out of respect, out of indebtedness, out of fear, out of, you know, because we were told to, out of obedience. If we repeat those things, then we are getting in our own way for trying to understand what they mean. You can never understand anything without recognizing, like, hold on, hold on, hold on. I don't know what that means. I don't know what's up with that. Okay, so just so you know. This is related to something that Baldwin says in the talk to teachers, and that's where I'll start. He calls this the paradox of education. The paradox of education, he says, is that a good education, as opposed to education that is supposed to make people into thoughtless repeaters of ideological dogma and thoughtless workers who do what they're told without any further discussion, that kind of education, that's what we don't want. But good education, a real education, that should make you more conscious, right? Shouldn't that make you more thinking? Shouldn't that make you more critical? Shouldn't it make you less likely simply to accept what a bunch of other people said and what has always been said, and more likely and more confident in saying, hold on, let me see about that. Just wait. Okay, so education, if it's about becoming more conscious and starting to ask our own questions, there's a paradox involved there, because we start off in a certain position within the society, and that position within the society, the classroom in this case, that position within the society leads us into a project of asking questions, ideally, and in this process of asking questions, we end up turning on the society itself. Now, I think a kind of conservative, and I would say anti-intellectual perspective would say, that's not cool. You can't do that. You can't turn back on the society, because it's the one that was teaching you in the first place. Have you no sense of shame? Have you no sense of patriotism? But Baldwin's position and mine is that actually there's no getting around that. All thinking beings have to question the world. And any honest thinking being has to question, it's not very critical to walk around asking, does North Korea suck? Is North Korea a dictatorship? Does Kim Jong-un and his regime tell the truth to the Korean people? Those are all, you know, reasonable questions, and we can answer them. And I'm sure you have ideas about the answers. But none of that stuff affects us, right? It doesn't bear upon us. And actually, I think what happens when we go around deriding Russia and Korea and China and so on is that we are secretly reaffirming a whole bunch of myths about us and the United States. So no, we don't become critical by doing that. We don't become actually thinking beings. We haven't actualized any of the potentiality we have to combine our thought and our action. That can only happen if we turn our critical gaze upon not something in the distance that's an easy target and that people here close to us would like us to be worried about instead of being worried about here. We have to turn our gaze upon our own situation. We have to ask about our own family, our own behavior, our own thoughts, our own classroom, our own school, our own so-called community, our own city, our own nation, our own army, our own society, right? Now, this is not just the absence of loyalty. In fact, it could be the opposite, right? If I don't use my actual mental and physical abilities for the people around me, with the people around me, and instead I just keep myself passive, I think I'd be kidding myself to say that I'm the best possible, I almost said American, but I think American is an abstraction. You know, the best possible man. I can't be the best possible man if I just accept everything that's given to me. I could be a good Nazi. I don't want to be a good Nazi. Anyway, so we got to ask these questions, right? So the paradox of education is that we have to turn back upon the society that we're a part of. And Baldwin here, I think, follows Socrates, who we'll look at next, when he says that when Socrates says that the role of the philosopher is to be a gadfly, you know, an irritant, someone who bothers and disturbs and pisses off the given society, and especially the power structure within that society. And then Baldwin says, and a society where, and Socrates says the same thing, a society which lacks that function, that critical function, that philosophical function, that questioning function, is a society that's going to die, that is in decline. Because if you don't have anyone causing you to actually say what the world is really like, if a whole society just goes on parroting a whole bunch of things which excuse that society, but actually entirely veil it, this is the best country in the world. Yeah, we had slavery, but it doesn't count anymore. It doesn't have anything to do with us. You know, if we just go on veiling things, and Coates says, look, that has everything to do with us. We still have racial structure within the society. If we just go on veiling things and we teach our kids to veil things and not to ask questions, we are producing a stupider and more pliant and just plain more deluded society, a deluded society. And a society that is deluded, that has no understanding of what's really going on in the world, what our country and our economy and our corporations and our military are really doing across the face of the world, what the world really is, where it is, who's there, what are they doing. A country full of people that only does this is doomed because it's mad. So far from thinking of asking questions as an act of... betrayal, perhaps we could come up with some kind of better patriotism, like a patriotism to those who are really around us, to actually deal with the truth and actually deal with our society. That's the idea. So he says, you know, we have to ask questions of the universe. We have to learn to live with questions. But, of course, power structures always want an obedient citizenry, and that means that philosophy and the asking of questions and actual thought are going to come into conflict with power, whether we like it or not. Here's an example of the kind of myths that Baldwin and Coates both think that we're living in. You know, we're supposed to believe, and this is Baldwin says, this is, we stay like children about this. We're supposed to believe that the country was founded by a band of heroes who wanted to be free, as if these men were somehow qualitatively different from us. We're, in fact, he doesn't say this, but it always strikes me, we are supposed to refer to these people as the founding fathers. Well, they're not my father. They're not related to me. I don't get it. Why are they my fathers? This is a part of a nationalist package that we're supposed to buy through school, and it has to do with unifying us, and I think in a lot of ways it has to do with making us obedient. But a whole lot of people really believe that, right? That we are special because James Madison and George Washington and Thomas Jefferson were special in some kind of qualitatively distinct from the rest of the world way. And Baldwin's like, come on, man. If you really go look at the history, go look at the Pilgrims. You know, were the Pilgrims people who were just looking for freedom? Nah, they were migrants who got kicked out of their own country for being a problem. Right? Now, let's talk about the world that it really happens, and we'll find out that there aren't so many heroes, and that even if there are heroes, they're very human, and that the country itself, there's nothing particularly distinctive about it, except for, perhaps, its military might and its centrality in the global capitalist order. And if you wanted to get really critical, there is something specific about the country, which is that it's one of the more racist countries in the entire world. It's also got the largest proportion of people in prison in the entire world, a massive percentage of which people in prison are people of color, not by accident, but for reasons that can be understood by looking at history. The idea that we should never look at history, or that history has nothing to do with us, is a fundamentally thought-stifling, even a mad, and definitely a childlike, childish position. All histories have something to do with the present. It is only by history that the present achieves the form that it has. It's never been different. It never will be different. That. Okay. So I'll just go straight to what I take to be Baldwin's central point. And I think these are some of the most striking passages I've read. And that's one of the reasons I put this stuff in here. He says, "The crime of which I accuse my country and my countrymen is that they have destroyed and are destroying hundreds of thousands of lives, but they don't know it, and they don't want to know it." So he says, "It is not permissible that the authors of devastation should also be innocent. It's the innocence that constitutes the crime." Now that is some serious, heavy stuff, and we should, work through it. And what I would like to claim is that it looks like this is simply an attack on white people. Although, you know, remember, Coates didn't just talk directly about white people. He talked about people who believe they are white. Even that idea that whiteness is not an inherent property, but it's a sort of identity which was made available to a certain portion of the population in order to split it off against the rest of the working class and identify it, even though the white people who got to be white were still working class, were still exploited, were still like totally at the whim of a few people in positions of real power, they felt that they had more in common with those powerful white people than they did with their neighbors of color who were in the exact same economic, otherwise in the exact same economic circumstances as them. So Baldwin actually has a very sophisticated view here, right? He's not just saying that white people are the problem, but he is saying whiteness is the problem, or is a part of the problem. Beyond that, what I always think when I read this stuff from 1963, 1965, is that in reality, it does apply to all kinds of people who neither are nor believe that they are white. I think this stuff applies to Americans in general. Okay, so we destroy whoever the we is here, and I'm culpable no matter what, right? this white male, middle class, middle age voice talking authoritatively at you. This is definitely me in my position, but I wonder to what degree it might also be you in your position. I think all of us need to work on it, right? The crime is that we destroy hundreds of thousands of lives, and we don't know it, but we don't want to know it. Now, the first application of that, clearly, in this context, is Baldwin talking to his nephew about growing up in ghettos. How come Baldwin in Harlem and his nephew after him were in ghettos? How come they were in all black areas, or mostly black areas, where this population was racially and especially economically segregated, such that being born into that area, their life chances and the possibility of them encountering violence versus the possibility of them becoming affluent or whatever, how come that happened to them? Because of the racial structure within the country. Now, you might like to say, because this is what Americans like to say, that, hey, that was history. That doesn't count anymore. We're over that, right? So, you know, we don't have a racial structure anymore. But, you know, look at Los Angeles. All of you know that there are black areas and Latinx areas and white areas. There are complications to that. And that is, you know, it start in the white areas. That in the white areas, there are actually, you know, there's so-called diversity. There are people of Asian background and people of African American background and people of Latin American background and people of Middle Eastern background and so on. So it's no longer exactly and only a racial structure, but it is still a segregated structure. And it's still got a whole lot of racial components to it. And if you really wanted to get into questions of race here, then you might start to ask, isn't it true that the people who live in the white areas also act like white people? They have striven to become white or to become more white. Maybe they talk more like so-called white people. Maybe they dress more like so-called white people. Maybe they vacation more like so-called white people, right? So the point here is that the racial question is intertwined with questions of power, structure, economy, class, all kinds of things, right? So the first crime of which he thinks we, whoever we is, are guilty is structuring the country in this way. But we don't know it, and we don't want to know it. So what's a way of not knowing that? Well, we can say, but everybody has equal opportunity, you know? You go to school, you try hard, you're going to get out of that scene, and that's good for you. And in fact, you're going to be the model American, the one who comes from rags to riches. This is our story. But insofar as we tell that story, don't we then say, like, and therefore it doesn't matter that the structure exists? But the structure does exist. And people are born into those circumstances. And not all of them get out. And in fact, only a minority gets out. So the majority stay there. By our acting as if this were not a problem, don't we keep that majority in conditions of violence and poverty? So that's number one. But I hear this stuff. You know, it is the innocence which constitutes the crime. And I hear American ideology on the whole. And I think there's a whole lot of people in my classes. There's a whole lot of people at the Cal States. There's a whole lot of people coming out of low-income areas in Los Angeles who are still involved in destroying hundreds of thousands of lives and not wanting to know it, and therefore being guilty of not being able to face what we ourselves do. So what other ways? Well, what about America's wars? Now, do you really know where the United States has military bases? Do you know that we have, I think it's 800 plus bases that are acknowledged, official bases, around the entire world? How come? That's for defense, right? What other country has 800 bases all around the world for defense? Well, we don't know and we don't want to know. It's only us. Now, that's not to say that there are not other countries vying for global power. Of course they are. That's what countries do. That's what capitalists do. But we don't know and we don't want to know where our tax dollars, where our bombers, where our brothers who are fighting and who they are fighting and why they are fighting. What is the history of Afghanistan? How do we end up with troops in Afghanistan for nearly two decades? We don't know, and we don't want to know. And as Baldwin says, it is the ignorance which constitutes the crime. So this thing, which is, you know, the refusal to look at history, the refusal to look at what we actually are involved in and actually are doing. I mean, you know, like I have friends who work for, you know, metal shops, and they make weapons, they make bombs. Most people in a situation like that don't want to, like, think about what does it mean that they make bombs. So those bombs get dropped on people. Who? You built the bomb, but you don't know who it's going to be dropped on? How responsible is that? You don't know, and you don't want to know, right? So I think, like, the formula that Baldwin is giving us here is way broader than just white people. But the problem of whiteness is central here, right? Okay, so I'm going to say that kind of encapsulates things, and I'll just add one thing at the end, and we'll be done. He's talking to his nephew, right? And he's trying to get his nephew to understand what the situation is. And he's also got a very critical perspective about the civil rights movement. Because one key thing that distinguished the civil rights movement from the Black Power movement was that the civil rights movement was aimed at integration. You know, everybody's just supposed to become a better American. Everybody's just supposed to become, you know, someone involved in the general structure, and they should have opportunity and so on. And on this model, it's, you know, generally that black people have to be accepted by white people. And that's what this struggle looks like from some people's perspective. Baldwin's like, that's actually not the deal. I don't want them to accept me. I don't need them to accept me. This involves, you know, like becoming white in behavior, becoming maybe shifting over class-wise, forgetting about culture, forgetting about the oppression of the people that you know. He doesn't want to become integrated in this way. You know, we'll look at Stokely Carmichael eventually. Carmichael will say, you know, integration is just another word for white power, by which he means that integration leaves the power structure intact. This is not what Baldwin wants. Instead, he says it's way harder, talking to his nephew. It's like, it's way harder. It's not that they have to accept you. It's that we have to accept them. They are our long-lost brothers. These white people, but I would say also these Americans, right? They have had to believe that they are superior because their identity rests upon it. Now, this is white identity. White identity is what it is. You know, a feeling of innocence, a feeling of normalcy, a feeling of empowerment, just by contrast with all the things that it's not. Black people, brown people, recent immigrants, people who don't speak English, criminals, all these are like not quite white, not quite American. Our sense of security, whoever our is here, whether it's white folks or Americans, seems to rest upon those others being less somehow. Well, at least we don't live in China. At least we're not Koreans. You know, at least we're not backwards like all those people in the Middle East. At least we're not the Muslim world, which is incompatible with modernity. These are all the same kind of statement where our identity and our pride gets built only through the demeaning of others. So, you know, Baldwin's comment here is that that's a problem, but the people who act that way are the ones with the problem. And we have to love them. We have to deal with them somehow. And how do we do that? Well, we do it by trying to understand the truth for ourselves, understanding our history for ourselves, understanding what we really are involved in. As Coates says, recognizing, because Coates is not innocent either, right? He says that. Recognizing that we are involved in all kinds of things which are objectively problematic. And we're doing all kinds of things right now that are part of structures of domination, globally and locally. This doesn't mean that we suck or that we should give up or that, like, this is not just, how did somebody put it last time? Shitting on America. This is not just shitting on America. This is an earnest attempt to improve America, right? To improve the people around you. The people who are around you who insist and spend their entire lives staying like children. So how are we going to deal with them? Let's try to understand for ourselves about what we're really involved in and what our real history is. And then let's try and, like, get them to know. And you'll find out that they don't want to know. They don't want to know But we have to try and convince them. And the real problem is that people knowing seems to have something to do with how you act, right? Can you really say that somebody knows that they're involved in, domination? They know that the bombs that they are making fall upon innocent children in Yemen because they're sold to the Saudis and all that. They know it, but they're not doing anything about it. Well, that's not exactly the modality of knowing that we want. That's a useless knowing, right? And it's not a full knowing because it doesn't put together these two halves that Frede talked about and Davis talked about of action and thought. What we want is for people to understand in such a fashion that their action begins to change. But Baldwin says, and this is really worth thinking about, to act is to be committed. To be committed is to be in danger. And so maybe underlying, just as Coates says, maybe underlying this entire set of delusional beliefs, you know, belief in myths, belief in children style stories about where we're at, what Baldwin calls the loss of a grip on reality. Maybe that loss of a grip on reality, as Coates suggests, really is driven by a fundamental fear. Maybe if we want to know this country, then maybe if we want to know our own real circumstance, then we have to start thinking about fear as well, where fear comes from, where it's at, where it's involved with us. And then go back to Coates, you know, what would be a real goal for a full-blown adult? To confront that fear and perhaps overcome it, or at least to figure out what it would mean to act from courage and to act like a full human being who is totally sober, does not lie to themselves or their children about how shit is. What would it mean to be that person who tells the truth to themselves and then actually adults up? Trying to substitute, what's the non-gendered man up? Adults up to do the right thing.